And good morning and welcome to this September 18th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. And we are inviting you, if you are a longtime listener or even a new listener to the show, to write in and tell us how we are doing. We welcome your suggestions, your feedback, so give us a shout. You can tell us what you want to hear more of, less of, formats, all that kind of stuff. You can write to Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net. Again, that's penonfire@earthlink.net. No coincidence, her website is penonfire.com. You can even write to me. You can write to me at mariestone@gmail.com. No coincidence, my address is mariestone.com. And I'm your host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors. This morning, we're doing something slightly different. We're talking about writing for artificial intelligence, writing for machines, where art meets science and technology. And I am on this morning, I pre-recorded this, but I'm on this morning with writer, poet, and human being who writes for machines, Mariana Lynn. Mariana Lynn's work has appeared in places such as the Paris Review, The Huffington Post, New York Magazine, The Mississippi Review, GQ, Time Out New York, Picture Magazine, and the BBC. She spent 6 years as creative director at Apple in global marketing. She oversaw creative work in digital, web, and video. Her team's work at the Clio award-winning iPad poetry campaign captured the beauty of human life in its use of technology. For 4 years, Mariana was the principal writer for The Elusive Voice of Siri. She oversaw its global personality, dialogue, and creative partnerships, and attempted to answer odd questions with wit and grace. She consults for Hanson Robotics Sophia, International Artists AI Installations, and Stanford University in a series of studies on AI and authenticity. She's spoken on creative writing for AI at Stanford University, MediaX Institute, United Nations AI for Good Summit, TED Global Summit, and UNESCO La Ciudad de las Ideas. She waxes on the craft of AI writing at the Paris Review in her column, Artificial Intelligentsia. Mariana has been lucky to find her life full of interesting people and has refined over the years an intrigue in the aesthetics and personality and voice. The question of what is AI, in her view, begins with the question of what is human. Mariana earned a BA in English Literature for Swarthmore College with coursework at the Sorbonne and Sciences Po in Paris, and a JD from Berkeley in Intellectual Property with a thesis on human bias. She's an MFA candidate in poetry at Pacific University, where her thesis examines death of identity in Lorca's Duende and Japanese death poems. She's been nominated for Best New Poets, and her poems have won finalists for the Mississippi Review Prize, the Arts and Letters Rumi Poetry Prize, and the New Guard Literary Review's Nightville Poetry Contest. So this morning, we're going to devote the hour to this intersection of writing and fiction writing and character development and poetry and all of the creative issues behind creating AI personalities and kind of what this all means. I am thrilled to welcome her on. Mariana, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. This is fascinating. The more I read, the more questions I have. So we're going to get into, hopefully we'll get into all of it.
just like me, the more I do this, the more questions I have.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
So that was sort of a long introduction and somewhat biographically thorough, but I'd love to hear your origin story into the work and kind of how you came to discover this intersection between writing and poetry and AI.
Well, it's sort of serendipitous. I've always been a creative writer since I was little. I don't say that to be pretentious, but it was just what I did. I mean, I loved that world, and I was always writing plays or poems and, you know, stories since I was young, and it was sort of as real for me as my real world. And so I went on to be an English literature major. I went on to write professionally as an editor nonfiction writer in New York, because that's sort of how you make a living, and was always still writing on the side. And I worked at I wrote for a few publications. I helped create the voice of this sort of cult underground publication in New York called Urban Daddy. And I think that voice, which won some Webby, a copywriting award, caught the attention of Apple, the head creative director, because there was some crossover in the sense that it was, you know, clean and witty and sort of unexpected and conversational, mm-hmm. which is sort of how I think of Apple's voice. And so, about 6-7 years ago, I moved out from New York to the Bay Area to work in the creative studio at Apple, which was an incredible experience. Worked with some of the most talented people I've had the pleasure of working with in developing some of the creative around Apple and its brand and its products and its history. And then about 4 years ago, I went to Siri to be the lead writer there. And that is how I ended up in that cross section. And I found myself to be kind of a stranger in a strange land, being, you know, in the creative studio, there was more of my kind, I suppose. But at Siri, which is all engineers and it's very engineering heavy, I found myself to be really the only person with a strong humanities and creative background there. And it was a really interesting experience navigating a culture that, you know, thought differently, that approached things a bit differently. And that was when I started to really think about, because I'd always worked as a writer in these sort of creative liberal arts humanities environments. And that was the first time it really opened my eyes, and I began to think about where art and technology truly met. And I think that was something Steve Jobs, embodied as well.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. I was going to ask you about that, about working with writers versus working with engineers, because they're such different animals. Those two brains are very different animals from each other. And
very different. Yeah. Very different. I mean, sometimes polar opposite, because, I mean, there are some similarities, but I think engineers, this is broad strokes, but engineers want to solve problems. So they need a problem set. They need a solution. Solutions. I think the one thing they have in common is this aspect of revisions. I mean, there's constantly, it's never done, it's always iterating. So I think that part, there's a lot of similarity. But in terms of approaching a creative problem, it's very different. I think artists and writers feel, you know, they absorb it even sensorially and then feel an experience by doing. And engineers kind of need to analyze the problem and have, like, very specific outcomes or solutions. And so it's very different. And the other thing is, I think about this a lot. In technology, it's all about reducing friction. So frictionless is this term you hear all the time, friction, reduce friction, you know, make it even easier, fewer taps, you know, your food shows up at your door, your car, you know, the less friction, the better. Whereas art and writing really thrives on friction. I mean, art needs friction, yeah. Writing needs conflict. Discomfort is where, you know, the beauty happens. And so I think that's why Apple is still singular in the field of technology, because I think Steve Jobs understood both, that you had to have ease and smoothness in some areas, but you had to have unexpected delight in others that only comes from doing something different. And so I think that's also been an interesting source of tension I've thought about a lot.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because now that you're saying it, you do want to have, you want to have friction in the right areas, right? You want to have emotional friction, but right. You don't want to have frustration in, you know, just getting something to work. That's never satisfying.
Exactly. And I guess the same, actually, hearing you say that too, the same applies in writing, because, you know, you want certain things to not create unnecessary friction where, you know, oh, I don't understand what this character is, or why did the narrative voice or the poetic voice just suddenly changed and I don't understand why. And that slows down the understanding. But then there are other areas of discomfort or ambiguity that you want to, like, that is the intention. So I think balancing that is also important in writing. But I will say, because the world is quickly moving towards a technology-oriented space and way of thinking and communication, and that's where the money is right now too, I really do think art and language is at risk of being deprioritized and not being integrated into this new world we're rapidly careening towards.
Right. So.
Right.
Yeah, are you kind of referencing the Twitter generation where, in addition to art not being as important, we're also compressing our thoughts and language down to, you know, a certain number of characters, and our attention spans are waning? Or are you talking about something else?
No, absolutely. That's a huge part of it, is just how our communication styles have changed between now and even 20 years ago. I mean, when I grew up, I was still writing letters. And so I have boxes and boxes of letters. And that form of communication was how I stayed in touch with friends. This was before, definitely dating me, but it was before the internet really was a thing and email really was a thing. And so, you know, letters made you slow down. The fact that you had one side of the conversation to tell your story for a few pages, that just changed the dynamic. And I think now, it's not just social media, but it's also texting people, right? It's like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So the rapidity, the reduction of attention span that also then reduces our urgency and the need to say it quickly, because we might lose their attention, or, you know, they might not have the patience to sit and listen to this. I think that all does something to language. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, the way the global world is moving in terms of aesthetics and money, it's really moving towards tech. So mm-hmm. I don't think art should be positioned as outside of tech. I think art needs to move into tech, because that's just, I think that's where right now the focus of our world is right now, at least on the commerce side.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Sophia, because I have to admit, I wasn't familiar with Sophia. But she's in addition to being kind of not just the disembodied voice like Siri is, she's a corporeal body in the world. And I'd just love for you to talk about her a little bit, and writing for, you know, Siri, who's this kind of disembodied, her-like voice, versus Sophia, who can, you know, move and talk and has facial expressions and everything else.
It's completely different writing for a disembodied voice versus a very, very physical voice. I almost say it's just different as writing a dialogue on a page versus a dialogue for a movie. You know, in one situation, like say in the Sophia situation, there is such a presence of not only her physicality, but her, you know, and by physicality, I mean the presence of a large, you know, whatever, how many pound body sitting in the room with you or looking at you. And then you have the face, you know, which has the skin and the flubber, they call it, which is the flesh rubber. And then there are the facial expressions, the blinking. And so all of that adds to the experience, and your words become, I don't want to say they're less important, but it's not as, you know, in the case of a disembodied voice, like Alexa or Siri, where the words are just, and the words and the tonal voice, the oral voice, are the forefront of that interaction. You can impose any kind of image you want on who you're talking to. You can, or, you know, not any at all. You can pretend it's an alien or this other thing. But with Sophia, you're interacting with all these other visual elements. And so that changes things. I think that, you know, you have to work much more closely with engineers and designers to say, okay, what is her expression going to be at this moment? Because if she makes this expression, I'm going to tone down this, you know, what she says, so that it complements that. Because if she kind of raises her eyebrow and does a odd face to express puzzlement, I don't need to really, you know, push that in the words as much. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you find that sometimes expressions are enough and you don't really need to say as much.
Here's a really techie, ignorant question, because I just don't know as much about how this works. So is Sophia a machine learning sort of being, where she, at some point, your personality in her will leave off and she can take over, or is everything about her programmed?
That is something more for the engineers there to speak to, because I think they're working on that. I know they have AGI there, and it's always a process, but I would say for now, for the most part, most of the voice interface interactions people interact with, it's largely scripted. And even if there's some machine learning, it will be slow, and it's behind the scenes, and it's tying human scripted things to a dialogue flow, if you will, like an intelligence of just, you know, where to move on the path, but not necessarily a completely, you know, a completely separate intelligence. So we're just really not there yet.
That'll probably come
for everybody. Yeah.
That'll probably come as some reassurance to people, because I mentioned our conversation to a couple of friends. Here's my sampling of five people. I mentioned, you know, that this conversation was going to happen, and everybody's, you know, four out of five of them looked super scared. They were like, oh my gosh, this is where this is going. And,
well, I think people are very, I think the media and popular culture has done a lot to create this mythology of fear. And then people actually in the industry who understand the technology behind it are the least scared. They're the ones saying, oh my God, it's like, we just can't get this to work. And this is in every industry across all companies, because I have friends in all the companies. I mean, it's just, we're so far from it. And I think the gap, I've never seen a bigger gap between reality and myth than in AI.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I mean, you have all of these, and we'll talk about this later in the hour, but you have all of these shows like Westworld and Ex Machina and some, you know, it's obviously that's it's their job to incite emotion because the movie is fun, but it certainly is not doing anything to alleviate people's fears in this arena, that's for sure. But yeah, very funny. So this is kind of a neat time, I think, to talk about, because of the discussion of Sophia and what she can do, what we expect out of a conversation and kind of an organic conversation that you can do when you're sitting there with a corporeal body. Even if you're talking to a person over the phone like we are, it's still possible, I think, through tone of voice or expression. You know, the conversation between us is certainly not the same as the conversation that you and I would have with Siri. But this idea of silence and pauses and white space that's so important in any human interaction, that becomes a little bit maybe more difficult in programming an AI being. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on what isn't said, kind of the white space and the pauses and all of that natural stuff, and how you think about injecting those when you're thinking about creating these personalities.
Yes, I think that I'm a huge fan of silence. I think, especially having an Eastern upbringing, there's the sense of space in conversations and personal interactions is very different to me in certain Eastern cultures than it is in America. And I say America even separately from Western cultures in Europe, at least as far as I've observed. Mm-hmm. So I think that silence is something that is more comfortable for other cultures. And I think there's a lot that can happen in silence. I think silence gives people space to even have micro moments to themselves in the middle of an interaction with someone else. It slows things down, so you're not always on this, you know, 30,000-mile train headed to some sort of end of the conversation or some kind of goal of understanding. And it's also just presence. I think it's just a simple presence that you know, in the whole mindfulness space or in yogic circles, it's that presence that we have a hard time accessing, whether with ourselves or with others, in this modern day with so much communication and information coming at us. Mm-hmm. So I think that silence is something that should be taken into account in writing for AI dialogues. You know, thought should be considered as to building in pauses, speed of the conversation, and if you have the ability with a face, whether it's an avatar or a physical face, or with Siri if there's a waveform, or with another machine if they're lights, you have the ability to show a bit of presence, this listening presence, that doesn't necessarily need to be saying something. And sometimes that can be, you know, very nice. I'm not really going to compare AI to animals, but I will for a second. I guess I am, even though I said I wasn't. But, you know, it's sort of like why some people really appreciate their relationships with their dogs. Like, their dogs are just there and they listen and they don't talk back, which some people like, but it's also just having that presence there. And, you know, and me personally, that's one of my favorite things to do is just, you know, have someone in the room and we don't have to necessarily say anything and we can do our own thing. So I think that there's ways to build, to just think about it, because in this field, no one is really thinking about that right now. It's very, the goal is immediately, the consideration is immediately, what do we say? What do we say? What do we say back? Oh, here's 10 ways we can say it. And actually just thinking about the other ways someone can show up for a conversation that isn't always, you know, this perfectly formed sentence.
I guess the movie that showed this the best, and I haven't seen it for a couple of years, is Her with Joaquin Phoenix and I forget her name. Who played her?
Scarlett Johansson.
Thank you. Yeah. And they did a really nice job of that. I mean, I remember there was some scene where, you know, they were just kind of laying in bed together at night. I mean, sort of together in quotes, at night. And really not that much was said, but they knew the other one, you know, or he knew she was there, I guess I should say. And it did show kind of the importance of silence in a relationship, and just the importance of presence and whatever showing up means for an AI machine. But you know, just the comfort that she was there, and not necessarily that they had to talk all the time. And I don't know. That's the best fictional example that I can think of silence being shown in an AI machine relationship that brought him some satisfaction.
And also when he put her in the pocket and she just got to experience the world with him.
Yeah, right.
Things like that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that movie is, I don't know. People always bring that movie up with me. It's not my favorite in terms of exploring the human-AI relationship, because it does feel, it's the simplest. So I think in some ways that is the easiest. It can be the most poignant in that regard. But I feel like there wasn't as much thought put into her, ironically her, there wasn't as much thought put into her personality and her role. It was felt to me like a very human-centered,
she was there to serve him.
On that relationship.
Yeah.
Yes, like 1,000%. And the only change at the end was, oh, I actually serve all these people, but that's so obvious that. So there are other shows, I think, or other fictional, ideas that have been a bit more philosophically interesting to me. But I think that one always strikes people because it's the closest to probably what they imagine is the current state. The ones where there's robots walking around among us, it's so far off if it will ever happen. And I think Her catches people's attention because it feels the most realistic.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't love it because I felt like the portrayal of the AI was pretty thin. And I also felt that the dialogue was so unrealistically realistic and the voice was so unrealistically human-like that that was just my personal take on it. I always think about how the robots are portrayed, but that's how AIs are portrayed.
No, well, that's that's why we're having you on. Well, that might be, I do want to give you a chance to read some of your own poetry. I think this is a good time to do it. But right before we do that, this leads into your very interesting discussion of the I and Thou. You did a wonderful article, and I encourage people to look this up, the Paris Review article on I and Thou and I and It and I and They. And this whole discussion of her and the thinness of her character, I think, speaks to that idea. And so can you kind of take us into that idea real quick, and then I'm going to give you a chance to read some of your own work.
Sure. So for one of my pieces, I wrote about how we can understand this AI, these AI characters that are being developed into our lives. And I felt like the AI was something, it wasn't quite a fictional character. I grew up with fictional characters. I loved, you know, my first crush was Sidney Carton from A Tale of Two Cities. I would write about him in my journal. I mean, I loved Harry the Spy. These fictional characters were probably more vivid for me when I was young than real people, and that probably tells you something about my human interaction skills. But but really, to me, that was sort of they were so real. You know, it was an easier way for me to access humanity growing up. And so I thought a lot about these AI characters, because the same characters we want to enjoy on the page and read about and enter our lives are not really going to be the same as the ones we want to interact with day in and day out and have them perform these functions for us. So I looked to Martin Buber's framework, which is so profound, and I just think everyone these days should look at it, because I think we're moving further and further away from real interactions. And he sets forth that I'm really dumbing it down and not doing him justice, but he puts forth that there are these two ways we can interact with people. One is he calls it, where the other person is this almost a commodity that there you can extract something from them. So the relationship begins with, what can you do for me? And we do this all the time. I mean, you're lying to yourself if we say we don't do this. We see someone, maybe they can help me with a job, or this person might be a potential mate, or, you know, even in very close partnership relationships, it's, what have you done for me lately? Like, this person is this thing to be extracted, extract something from, right? Even if it's a feeling, right? Like, even if we say, oh, I love how this person makes me feel, we are still approaching that relationship with an intention of some sort of extraction. And so then he sort of suggests there's this other relationship called I vow, and it's much more holy, it's much more beautiful, and for lack of a better way to sum up what he says, he calls it an I vow relationship, where it's this universal presence of two, and it's just presence, and out of that comes something different than that could come out of the I it. So I was thinking about, you know, what about these fictional relationships, you know, that I was so close with? What about, you know, what, you know, Sydney Carton did for me, or what the, you know, all these people that I, these characters I grew up with, and still love and still think about. And I sort of came up with a third category. So I just added on, I tacked on to Martin Buber's, and I said, you know, these entertaining relationships, or maybe engaging relationships, I would call it I that. So maybe this is a one-way transaction. We know that your one side of the relationship is showing up just to entertain. And this is, you know, these are the characters we see on television too, that the ones we're very sad to see when the series ends, because we feel like we've come to know those characters and they've taken up emotional and psychic space in our lives. And, you know, and we talk about them with friends as if they exist. So these are these, you know, the characters we see on television that do unify us as well. But the thing with the I that relationship is that it's up front, right? Like, you are here to entertain me. It's a one way, you know, you're here to serve. And I was, at the time I wrote the piece, I was thinking, you know, maybe AI is some form of the I that relationship. But I think I've since looked at it again, because this field is so rapidly changing, and I'm constantly reforming my thoughts on things, and, you know, with more experience and everything like that. And I think AI might be a bit of all three, actually. The ideal AI relationship to me might capture all three. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be there, because, you know, they are built right now to help us meet human ends, and hopefully they'll be good human ends. But they're here to perform functions for us. There's a bit of the I-thou presence. If we can get that in there, that would be wonderful, to have that presence of just, you know, enjoying company, people really delighting, for example, in things Siri says about Siri's life. Mm-hmm. Like, they love that. And that's pure I-thou presence of just laughing and enjoying each other with no goal. And then the I-that experience has to be there too, which is that the entertainment, the slight bit of entertainment where, you know, it says something funny. It's there to develop a persona for you to enjoy outside of the function and outside of the presence. So that's sort of my take on the whole relationship framework.
I imagine that you would have learned so much about human nature and human curiosity and humanity in general by the questions that people ask of Siri about the nature of existence. You know, everybody loves sitting around watching her, listening to her espouse on, you know, religion and the meaning of life. And that would be very revealing, I think, and probably helpful to you maybe as a writer, going back to just working on your own fiction and your own poetry, about what people in their perceived privacy of their own moment are curious about and want to hear from her.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people... not only, have we heard questions from people all around the world in every, culture and language, so we see the differences, but also the similarities, the things that all people want to ask about humanity. But there's also a sense of that intimacy and that responsibility for people asking philosophical questions to personal ones. And, there's an incredible amount of privacy with Apple. It's the company that absolutely has the best privacy issues. So it's never connected to people. But over an aggregation, you really get that sense. And I think that's why Siri's personality has stood the test of time. It's found that balance between service and wit and having its own sense of self. And writing for Sophia and other AI characters, you hear the same questions. That people ask Sophia a lot of similar things about humanity because they're finally getting to talk to someone that is interacting with us but isn't one of us but has a voice, in our language. So the first questions are always, what do you think of humanity? And it goes to, we're horrible, right? Or yeah. What do you think about war? And all these kinds of questions that we don't ask each other. So I think those things have definitely helped me as a writer as well, because it got me out of my tiny self and my tiny circle into this, global conversation between humans and this new form of identity that's being formed.
Do you find that when you're writing whatever you're writing outside of AI, you're writing your poetry or you're writing fiction on the side, that some of those ideas and things that you're grappling with in your writing and creative life bleed into the personalities, like, is it easy for you to separate and compartmentalize your technology and work life from your creative life? Because I feel like whatever I'm working on creatively, that's just kind of the lens through which I see the world for a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's small amounts of separation, and then there are parts that can't be separated. So, for example, people ask me, do I always have this AI's voice in my head when I write for another AI? Well, no. I mean, they're just totally different characters. It doesn't even occur to me. But, or do I carry, Sophia's voice or Siri's voice or other AI's voice when I sit down to write a poem? Or no, not at all. I don't even have to exercise a muscle for that. I don't know why, but that's just the way it is. But if I'm currently obsessed with something at the cellular level, for example, a certain book or a certain food or, a certain artist that I'm reading about, will those references seep into no matter what I'm writing? Yes.
Yeah.
But they will seep in appropriate to whatever I'm doing, whether it's a poem or, suddenly I'm writing for an AI character and I need a reference for, some food. Well, those things will come up. But I don't really control all that. I think I'm just sort of mostly describing what I've experienced happen.
Right, right. Which is fun because that's what gives these gives these AI personalities and characters whimsy, right? I mean, it's all, you don't want an AI character who's very static. And this really interesting discussion of you don't want a character who mirrors back to you bad behavior. You had mentioned to me that a lot of people make either racist or sexually charged or whatever comments to Siri, and you would not want a character to mirror back to them that's acceptable, nor would you probably want a big brother living in your kitchen to, censor you and monitor you. So I don't know, all those questions are so fascinating. So my guest this morning is Mirjana Lynn, and I love in her bio, she describes herself as a writer and human. And this would be a really nice time, I think, for you to read. Can you read some of your poetry? And then that'll be kind of a really nice platform, I think, to talk about the even more intersections between creativity and AI.
Sure, that would be wonderful. Okay, so I will read a poem called A Given State. And this is referring to, it's an ekphrastic, so it's referring to Etant Damné, which is Marcel Duchamp's last phenomenal piece. So it's called A Given State. I was 13 when I looked through the hole in the door, not knowing. The square white walls of the gallery vanished before the gleaming skin, the the beds of twigs, the slit between her legs, chasm like a split and pitless peach. The waterfall trickled, a small and far-off wetness. In that moment under the spare lights of the Philadelphia Art Museum, I disappeared, fell from darkness to darkness, saw hair catching on brushes, fans opening, seams reddening, lace put back in place, except when it wasn't, bees and meadows circling and circling. I sat in waiting room, sitting room. On every floor I fell. I undressed, was undressed. I saw skin felting over a skull, a chest, then graying like a mouse. I saw crowns of black and brown and golden-headed boys break through our blood to seize the air and declare, I am here, here you are. What happens next is inevitable. A girl swam up a waterfall, only to end up sprawled, light in hand and faceless. Are we living or dead? Standing there in Philadelphia in 1989, I no longer knew, and I remember a young man came up next to me to look through the hole, and I stepped back, but not far. Afterwards, he looked at me, and we just stood there, breathing.
So beautiful. That was Mariana Lynn. That was published, where was that published?
This one actually is an older one, and it's not published yet.
Well, you got to get on that. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, all of art makes me think, and this poem in particular makes me think of just the importance of surprise and what that you would never anticipate. As I had read this before, and then as you're reading it now, I would never anticipate the next line. I could never see where this was going, and that seems like the disconnect in where AI was maybe 2 or 3 years ago and where maybe it is today. Of it's very predictable, right? You kind of can tell what if you tell Siri to turn on jazz music, that's exactly what she's going to do, versus this playful seeing the world from just a totally different perspective, not being able to anticipate what the other person is going to say next, and the pleasure that gives you, as well as in poetry, the rhythm and the rhyme and the meter and the space breaks and all of that is so pleasurable. And I assume all of that goes into your creation of these personalities when you're thinking about them to make them satisfying.
Yeah, well, I love that element of surprise that you mentioned, and it's something that I felt was just, a really incredible way to look at, connecting this poem to writing for AI. I hadn't really thought of that, but it's absolutely true, because the thing with life and personalities is that they're very messy and they're very unpredictable. I think artists especially and writers, like, we love the messy stuff. We love the unexpected stuff. The stuff that's expected is not as interesting. Our eyes and our ears and our bodies move to the weird, and it keeps us at the edge of our seats. And I think that, like you said, it's that expected path of language is what's happening more and more in AI. Success in AI dialogue these days, defined by the tech industries, is defined as, this clear, and we delivered everything the person wanted to say in a very appropriate way, and we didn't offend anybody. But that's not where life to me is, and that's not where real art and real great writing is to me. It's always in surprising people. And the problem with the surprise element is that it's not going to be to everyone's taste necessarily. It's not the safe route. It's the risky route. You might offend some people. You might make some people uncomfortable. So I think that is the challenge that's ahead for companies building AI personalities. How much are they willing to risk keeping art? And really, this is what's human. I mean, human, you just cannot control it. You can try to predict. You can try to create algorithms to create patterns. But ultimately, the thing humans will always be able to do, that's very human, that machines can't, is just create chaos and just to do something unexpected out of the pattern. And we do it even, you know, without realizing we're doing it. So, yes, I love that you saw that, because I think, you know, the journey, this feeling like you're going on this journey with somebody and you don't know what's around the corner has a different feeling of relationship than, oh, let me just, you know, do absolutely the right thing that you need right now and just respond to you just how you like it.
Right.
And I've got it all under control, so don't worry. That's a very different feeling.
Right. And yet it's also really interesting in the chaotic world that we find ourselves living in today where, you know, there's so little that we can actually rely on minute by minute, really, politically.
Yeah, it's the illusion. I mean, that's the thing, is that control in any sense is really an illusion. I mean, it's not really real because, you know, we're all careening in a direction that, you know, we're way more anxious than before. We have way more, you know, people are depressed. People are constantly wanting to get away from technology at the same time that they're drawn to it. So it's that sense of control is an illusion. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I chose to read this poem over others is that it was a sense of the whole poem. If you think about it, it was all silence. It was, you know, a person going up experiencing no idea what they were about to see, this entire internal experience of another person coming up. And then, you know, obviously there's gender, relational, you know, elements to this too. And this other person comes up to experience, and then they're standing next to each other. So there's physical proximity, and yet there's not a word being said. And yet they both shared this experience in two different ways. And I think this captures what art can do for us, the internal experience of it. And that shared experiences don't really have to be, you know, full of language and explication and direction.
Yes.
And I think that's what I hope we don't lose with the building of AI and technological relationships, that we don't lose, you know, that surprise, the physical. And I think the other thing is that, like, this, it's a very physical experience that you have to, like, I actually read this poem workshop, and my instructor, Kwame Dawes, who's, you know, a wonderful poet and professor, he said, oh, you guys should all take a look at this. You know, you have to look at the YouTube version, he said, because it sort of shows the physicality of this piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another thing, is that with the internet, now we could look at art, you know, on an image, or we could even see a video, you know, of what it's like to walk up to something. But it's not the same as, like, we're physical sensory beings, and this is another way we're completely different from machines. And nothing can really replicate that. So I think also, like, the physicality of that experience, and then the physicality of standing near someone who just had that experience, potentially different experience, I think it's all, like, very, I guess this poem could potentially be very anti, you know, anti-tech. And by anti, I don't mean against, just like opposite of, you know, counter-tech.
Yes,
like
right. No, right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. That's so interesting. Is it appropriate to call, like, what's the appropriate pronoun for a lot of these? And do you put in gender, like, is gender a consideration, or what is the best way to think about them?
Oh, I think gender is definitely a consideration, and most people had, you know, gender in mind. Siri was always created as genderless, but you could choose a voice, and then, you know, we were constantly, you know, correcting people. Siri is Siri. It's not her. It's not him. Siri. But other people creating AI make that choice. People decide, you know, Sophia is a female. Some people decide this AI will be male versus female. And then, of course, there's a lot of gender-neutral AI persona and voices coming out, which I think is a great thing, if only because then, as writers, we get to use the word there and not worry about the him, her, slash.
Yes, right, right,
one of
right.
The best things to happen with the gender. I'm joking, but I'm not joking. It's great. No, it's a really great consideration, and I think AI gives us an opportunity to step outside of ourselves and think about you know, new ways to look at assumptions we've always had. I do think that I've thought a lot about the gender thing. I do think that there's a lot of buzz going around, you know, oh, there's all this misogyny inherent in building female AIs, and I think that's definitely true. But I also think that part of it, I was thinking about this myself, and I thought, you know, if I had a robot in my house, and Ian McEwan starts to talk about this a little bit in his book Machines Like Me, which I haven't finished, but it's, I think I feel really uncomfortable with a male robot. It's just physically mm-hmm. more threatening to me. I feel more comfortable with a female. So there's something about the female presence that's more comfortable, I think, for men and for women. So I just don't think we can discount that, because yes, there are social biases there, but there are also physiological safety feelings there that are very deep that we're not even aware of in terms of the first things that we built. So I definitely do not think I want a male humanoid in my house anytime soon. So.
Right.
I mean, maybe, but, you know, we have to see how the technology went. So.
Well, and, you know, and the, I guess the corollary question is about culture, and, you know, that you had brought this up a little bit earlier, and I think it's a really fascinating question about the role of culture and cultural expectations and cultural curiosities and the kind of the rhythm of their language is totally different. And, you know, one of the conversations that we have on this show a lot is that humans are far more similar than we are different, but there are ways in which we are different. And I assume that, you know, that also has to play its role in creating these personalities.
Very different, very different. And I think that language is something that should be considered, because a lot of, you know, the writing is done in a very small part of the world, you know, which is like the Bay Area, you know, Silicon Valley, and by a certain group of people with a certain type of diction and a certain type of, you know, cadence. And, you know, in poetry, it's often said that the best poets are the ones writing outside of their original language. And I think it's because they just don't have those same ruts of cliches and patterns. So I always love reading poetry in translation. I always love hearing the differences of people to whom native English is not their native or mother language. I love hearing them speak English. It's always so much more delightful to me. So I think that those elements should be considered in creating AI, because right now there's a lot of press more just to make it sound perfect.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think people want things perfect. I think perfect is a bit creepy. And I don't think people want language perfect. And people don't speak perfectly either. Mm-hmm. I mean, they speak very fragmented and grammatically incorrectly to AI. So it's just, you know, conversation is different from writing. So we have to, you know, I think account for that and put the energy towards the joy and the delight and like why we're all here, rather than getting this product perfect. That's sort of, I guess, what I'm, you know, trying to say.
And to that end, we also talked about humor and the importance of humor and how much people love humor. Although that too is a characteristic that can change, you know, look at my mother and I and our different senses of humor, but, you know, what some people find funny versus what other people do. But that, you know, that's such an important part of human interaction. And humor, it feels to me, knowing nothing about AI, would be difficult because it's so much about timing and rifting and improv and all of that. And, you know, you don't have to tell me how you accomplish that, but I assume all of that goes into your thinking when you're thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I think humor in AI, as you pointed out, is really different. I do think that, so one thing that is so interesting about humor is that no matter which AI project I'm asked to write for, no matter what character, no matter what product, feature, whether it's art or for a mainstream product, there's not one single person that says, but we don't want it to be funny. I mean, everybody
right.
loves humor, right? Like, even if it, I mean, maybe it's a matter of how or how much or where. But everybody loves humor, and I think, number one, that says something to us about what we value in the human experience, like, you know, what we love, you know, to experience every day, right? Like, that's,
right.
It, to me, it puts humor at a very high, like, spiritual level, if you will, or just sort of, like, you know, in art or whatever. I cannot do anything if I'm not having fun, if I don't get to laugh or make jokes. It's just, I feel very kind of small and boxed. But you're right in that in writing for AI, timing is not really the same. You don't really have, it's not like human humor where delivery and I mean, delivery actually is part of it with AI, and you can play around with voice for that. But timing is definitely not going to be one of them because you can't rely on the latency, the technology to kind of have that perfect timing. So it relies very, very heavily on the script, very heavily on the words themselves. And I think you'd be surprised that there are some things that people find universally funny. It's just, I wouldn't know how to describe it, but I definitely know from writing for various things and a lot of them speaking to global audiences, there are just things, you just start to develop a sense like people are going to find this funny and people, you know, and that's not going to be funny. I do think that part of it is, so it's not to say the sense of humor is the same around the world. It's just that maybe writing for AI humor is different from writing for human humor.
Mm-hmm,
or,
right.
You know, by that I mean coming from. But the other thing that's pretty interesting about humor is that, you know, when I see a lot of people starting off writing for AI, there's a lot of cliche. There's now a body of what I call it cliche AI humor. And those are things like, oh, things about getting wet or getting unplugged or, you know, battery light. And it's just sort of like, you know, those other things where I'm like, okay, now we actually have a body of like bad AI humor at this point, cliches. Like, let's stay away from these things. Because when you know, it's like anything else. You just got to do it, you know, with time and with, you know, doing it over and over, you start to learn like newer ways of finding that humor. So,
right.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Do you give any thought to backstory, you know, as like Sophia, as a disembodied or, you know, as an actual corporeal person in the world, do you think about her backstory and kind of, you know, her origin story and work that into her personality?
Yeah, I think, and I'll speak for all characters rather than, you know, I don't want to speak just for Sophia because I don't know what, how much Hansen wants, to be, you know, revealed, but in terms of all AI, backstory is really important. And I think that there's two elements to backstory. There's the human backstory, which I think is important, or the human origin story. So that's, you know, who created me in what lab, you know, what that kind of thing. Who are my siblings? In Sophia's case, she actually has some siblings in the lab. And then there's the AI origin story, and that's where you can get more fantastical, and does it come from a different galaxy or dimension, or, you know, what was the formation of that? And that's where it could be fun and really different for each creature or personality. But all those things are important because even if they're not, it's sort of like in character writing for fictional other media like screen or play or story, even if it never shows up, it drives the writer. It gives senses of choice, it gives senses of motivation and valence and force that, you know, may not be obvious, but it's what people feel is a stronger and more robust character. And you can feel it because when I listen to AI, and I don't mean to denigrate what's out there, it's just that like there hasn't been a lot of resources, to be frank, to put into this, like creative resources, and I hope there will be more of that. But when I listen to other AI dialogue, it's like you could just feel how thin it is because there's just been no thought at all put into backstory. You could feel that once you've been doing it long enough, you can feel that from like a sentence and, you know, choices and things like that. So, yeah, I think backstory is really important and fun. You know, I think it's like because you want to know who you're writing for.
Yeah.
You know.
right.
Yeah.
Well, to that point about, and we had kind of started with this point at the beginning about the difference between engineers and writers. I wonder if this is going to be a big up and coming field for writers in general, that, you know, that the engineering teams will come to understand the value of the humanities team and what it can add to their world. And, you know, maybe this will be a new opportunity as writers are getting squeezed out of some of the other areas that they've traditionally written for, if this is a place where, you know, there might be an expanding market for writers to work in, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel that writers are getting pushed out?
Well, you know, I mean, literary journals are kind of falling apart here and there. Some of them are making replays. But as you were saying, you know, that the creative arts are a little bit less valued in favor of, I think, a lot of technological, you know, relying more on technology. People aren't reading.
Right.
We always talk about people not reading as much as they should be.
Right. Yes. No, I absolutely think that this is, I think one thing that's encouraging about poetry is that the readership has gone up in the last few years. I think the American Academy of Poets published a study, and they actually thought it may be attributed to social media, in which it's like easier to digest small amounts of, you know, condensed language. Mm-hmm. But yes, I agree with you that the whole publishing industry is sort of figuring its way through all of this. And I hope that there is value to be found in this area for writers and for people that, you know, are really, really deep into the writing and the arts. And because it's the best way is integration. It's not separation. It's to integrate these facets of our society. And there's so much room for it. And there's so much forgiveness for, look, we love Netflix and our characters and our, you know, if we're not reading them now, at least we're watching them, you know, and the character and, you know, even the content we're consuming is going through faster, but a great character that took time to develop, you know, the Seinfelds, the, yeah. You know, the Nancy Drews, the, you know, those Odysseus, those characters that just live on forever. Those is writers that built that, right? It was creators that built that. And those characters can live on in other ways. And I know that everyone, right, the reason I think there's not a lot invested in it right now is that people are very focused on making the technology work, which I understand, of course. But there's a lot of forgiveness in something not working and acknowledging that when there's at least some thought put into this identity that's like we've invited into our homes and into our spaces. So, but I think only writers think that way, right? Like engineers right. don't think that way. They right. will just think like, okay, we'll do this first. And then once that comes, we'll hire that person. And I think it takes like a softer eye and a softer ear for these kinds of interactions that really will keep AI human. You know, I think people in tech want AI to be human, but maybe they just don't know what that looks like. And I think it's the writers that really will bring that voice to the field. And I really, really do hope, like you said, that this is what happens because I think we need it. And you know, if we're not reading it because our attention spans are shrinking, maybe we'll listen to it. And a lot of these AI beings that will speak, maybe they'll, you know, they'll speak more poetically, you know, they'll speak in a different cadence that's kind of magical, you know, instead of like, thank you, you're welcome. Maybe thank you. They'll say like, and I bid you adieu, you know, or, you know, just something just right. wonderful that, you know, just makes our day in a different way that we, is emerging of technology and literature. So.
It's so funny that you should say that because the engineer piece of AI, I'm just thinking of like, you know, when I'm composing a Gmail, email in Gmail, it will, you know, try to predict my response based on what the other person wrote, or it will, obviously it'll correct okay. your grammar and your spelling, which it's done for a long time, but now it's trying to do predictive, why don't I write this for you? And I'm like, why don't you not? You know, I have my own ideas of what I'm going to write. So it is funny how the AI, how the machines are also trying to help us as writers and, you know, kind of generally dumbing it down. But as you say, as the writers take over more of their creative process behind the AI, maybe that, you know, that will get a little bit more elegant and whimsical and fun and, you know, surprising.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's actually a great area for some great creative thinking is the autocorrect functions. Why not make them, you know, why not bring up, you know, lines of Shakespeare or poetry
right,
or, you
yeah.
know, references to mythologies, you know, I mean, but the other thing I have to say is that's also where the writers will see the delight that may be missed by others is that, you know, I often find those autocorrects incredibly funny and better than what I was intending to write. And
yes.
that can get integrated into language and creation, you know? So it's sort of like not seeing it as AI as the enemy, but just seeing it as, you know, that Martin Buber eyed out, like what happens when they both show up and not, we don't have to, one doesn't have to control the other, but you know, what wonderful things can come out of it. And I've always thought that robots could really help poets and writers because cliches and ruts, are one of those things we try to avoid at all costs, but it's so hard when those neural paths have been worn down. So if I say, you know, I'll go out on a, I mean, you have to work so hard to not say think limb, but, you know, AIs don't have those patterns built in. So I could you know, they could randomize language in a way that, you know, non-native speakers do and just say something really interesting that's a little bit left. And I think in those ways, I really do think AI can help artists and writers with their process.
Yes.
Not with the outcome, but with the process.
Right. So. Exactly. Exactly. God, what a fascinating conversation. Yeah. Where can we find more about you?
Well, I try to stay a little off the radar with social media. So I need my space, but I have a website.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Yeah, perfect. I have a website.
So. I love it. Yeah. I love it. Mariana Lynn, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. This was so much fun. It was really a wonderful conversation. And thank you.
So much fun. And that is all the time we have for today. But thanks so much for tuning in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. If you missed any part of that interview, it will be up and available via podcast. You can follow us again on iTunes, Writers on Writing. Stay tuned for more great programming. Rock Coaster is coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks again for joining me. Have a great week.